This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm tardy again. You're going to have to dock my pay. We are in an interesting situation here. First, looks like we have both JB and Kirk. How are you, fellas?
Good evening.
We're doing good.
I'm up tomorrow morning. I think I'm going to have my connectivity issues resolved. I was telling Jerry McLaughlin, my good friend, how costly it is to work for free and give away something worthwhile. But we are tomorrow going to, I think, end up with much, much better connectivity. Today and tomorrow, however, are extraordinarily challenging here. For those who have followed this saga, I'm still in Fort Lauderdale, expecting to push off for a six-month cruise on Tuesday morning. But today, the winds blew at about 30 knots most of the day. They're supposed to blow at 40 knots tomorrow. A sailboat just pulled in behind us. I helped them dock, which is what I was doing, that was actually out in it today, and they were in 20-foot seas. Now, a 20-foot sea may not sound like much.
It does.
But, you know, I'm in an 82-foot boat, and the ceiling of my pilot house is 20 feet above the water. That means if it were a BMC, you'd be standing up. You'd have to look up to see the top of the waves on the third deck of the boat. They were talking about they would surf down the waves and then have to power up them. And they were taking green water up, you know, halfway in the mast. The masts were leaking. It's just extraordinarily nautical. And I want to take a moment because I was thinking about it today as I was listening to the news and reading some articles. There's a worldwide march by students for global climate change. And some things that are really interesting in this regard, and I think it's pertinent for those of us who embrace the Iowa's testimony. There is climate. Climate is undeniable. The Earth has had climate for, I would say, a better part of, about 5 billion years. Mm-hmm. Climate has been terrible and not so terrible during that period of time. And it does change. So there is no denying climate change. We have climate and it changes.
There is been this thing called the Ice Age.
Yes, we did. And the Ice Age wasn't a lone event. It wasn't a solitary event. There were many ice ages. Right. They're cyclical. There are long patterns and short patterns as it relates to the Earth's climate. For the last several million years, there's been a short pattern that lasts about 600 years. Warms for 600 years, cools for 600 years, warms for 600 years. And because the recorded history goes back now about 5,000 years, we can trace the effects of global warming and global cooling during these 600-year cycles over humanity. For example, the catastrophic collapse of civilizations right around 1500 BCE. I don't know if any of you have studied that, but right around 1500 BCE, virtually every major civilization on Earth fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
The cold period. The burgeoning of Greece and the initial birth of Rome, warm period. The fall of Rome and what we'd consider even the Dark Ages, cold period. Mm-hmm. Renaissance, warm period. The last cold period ended right around 1850. And so, getting out of a cold period is when what's called the Spanish flu, but it was actually anthrax. But if you look at the reason that there was such death during the bubonic and black plagues, was because people were malnutrition. The same plague exists today. The virus for the plague is found in a number of places on Earth. It just doesn't kill people en masse because we're better nourished today. And they were poorly nourished at that time because it was a cold period. You couldn't grow crops. So global warming for humankind over this period of time is a very good thing. So to deny global warming, you'd be just ignorant. But the issue really is, to what degree is man responsible for these global warming and cooling periods? And you know how long mankind has been clearing forests?
That's
been over 5,000 years. Yeah, about 5,000 years. That's not new. If you look at places like Greece, Greece doesn't have forests anymore because they harvested all the wood because they wanted to build ships.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of places like that. So man has been doing that for a long time. Carbon burning carbon fuels is fairly new. But the levels of carbon in the atmosphere are nowhere near what they have been in the past. The issue is man doing things that are negatively affecting climate? Yeah, probably. And it's probably, we're doing some things that would cause the Earth to be a little cooler and some things that would cause it to be a little warmer. Pretty much an offset. The things we're doing to make it a little warmer is that burning, we can't say fossil fuels because they really aren't primarily made of fossils, but carbon-based fuels make it a little warmer. But all of the debris that we pick up in the atmosphere with all of our movements and shenanigans reflects heat. So in that degree, we're cooling the Earth. But the real issue is, to what degree? Is man responsible for 95% of the climate changes as a... doom and gloomers of the politicians would make you believe, media would say?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And in fact, it would be tough to really argue the point is that man responsible for 5% of it. This global warming that we're experiencing would have transpired from the global cooling around 1850 if there wasn't a single person on the planet. Matter of fact, if you were to obliterate every person on the planet, the change in the warming cycle would be so negligible as to be almost immeasurable. Like it might even be counterproductive with all the rotting carcasses. But it would be insignificant. So that's the first issue, is to realize that the mankind may be contributing some, probably is some, but his contributions are both positive and negative, and
minuscule.
Maybe, yes, minuscule, less than 5%. The second issue is, so what? So let's just say that we are, and there's some things we're doing that are stupid. I mean, our throwing away of plastic and the continents of plastic in the oceans. Bad stewardship of the planet. Shouldn't be doing that. The acidification of the seas and the effect that it's having on like coral formations and fish and overfishing with these dragnets. There's lots of things that we're doing. Burning down the Amazon. Yeah. And lots of things we're doing to show poor stewardship of the planet that we ought not be doing. I think hunting whales, for example, is bad stewardship. They're mammals. They're bright creatures. We ought not be doing that. The Japanese should be shamed for doing it. But my point would be that if mankind were to do this, would focus 100% of its energies on doing nothing but trying to counter global warming, we might make a 2-3% impact on the global trend of warming. We might. And we destroy every economy in the process. And then by globalization and global control and by shifting priorities from making things that are useful and that are productive to focusing strictly on climate, millions and millions of people would die. Life would become less and less free. The consequence of doing it would be catastrophic and negative, and the benefits almost infinitesimal. So then you have to ask, so why do so many scientists tout this as the cause celeb? Why are so many politicians in favor of it? And why, if you speak out against it, you're called a climate denier and you're lambasted? Now, I was talking to my ex-captain, and he said, you know, how in the world can you say that man's not responsible for global warming when every scientist on the planet says that he is? Well, first, every scientist on the planet doesn't say that we are. And you're posing the wrong question out of context. It gets right back to the same thing we talk about all the time with Yara. Things have to make sense in context. And if they don't make sense in context, then it doesn't matter. And in this particular case, yes, man is contributing some to global warming, some to global cooling, but his overall influence is negligible. And if he were to devote 100% of his resources to resolving his insignificant influence, the consequences would be catastrophic. And you put all of mankind into global control, into wealth redistribution, which is what the liberal agenda is. And the belief system in this is so ingrained in political correctness, where you're not allowed to question it. You're mocked if you question it. You're mocked if you even address it in a rational way and in context. And so there can't be an enlightened conversation on it. People are just universally manipulated. And the younger people are, and the less common sense they have, the more prone they are to be manipulated. But it is one of the two ways that the media and government are working in harmony to control people's lives. It is a control mechanism, and that's really what the whole agenda is. It's a control mechanism to take from the productive and give to the unproductive.
But my question is, people who are smart enough to manipulate or should be smart enough to realize that when you can try to control everything, you basically destroy everything. If they manipulate everything, there's no incentive. It's like communism was always taught. If you have no motive to get up and make work a little harder to make a little more or to produce more apples to sell more fruit, then why the heck will you if you get paid exactly the same as your neighbor? And then people just don't. If I could fertilize and still get the same money for all my coffee beans, you know, and ruin the land and eventually degrade the product, people stop buying it. That's what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah, and it's worse than that. Because if you are productive, you're shamed by society. If you are productive, you're paying the preponderance of the taxes that are given to those who are unproductive, and then you're told that you're not paying your fair share. When the unproductive are paying nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the productive are paying the lion's share, and they're shamed.
But everybody has to eat on the same plate. So where do they get their food if you destroy?
Well, they're not smart.
Isn't that what happened in China?
Yeah, and what would happen if this is climate change all over again? If you were to confiscate everything that productive nations and people produce and give it to the unproductive wouldn't even be satiated. It wouldn't last a month. And then what? You know, when you take incentive away for people to be productive, for the first 20 years of my work life, I worked between 80 and 100 hours a week. I made payroll out of my own pocket. I mortgaged my home. So I made hundreds of decisions every day that were gut-wrenching, where if any one of them was wrong, you fail. You know, the difference between the really successful companies and those that are not is to a large degree, good luck. Because no one can make all right decisions. So somewhere along the way, the bad decisions turn out not to be catastrophic, and the good ones turn out to have a little better result.
Yeah.
But this whole concept of political correctness has rendered a generation of people just extraordinarily easy to manipulate, where they can't fathom that mankind isn't responsible for global warming, and they'll march worldwide on behalf of it and not be able to figure it out. And it's the same thing with the conspiratorial types. They'll latch on to a theory, and no amount of evidence of reason, no amount of context will dissuade them. The same thing with a religious person. The whole mindset is just horrible. So anyway, I did want to share that. We are in an interesting period with Israel. Another election and no results. I think I've mentioned it before several times, particularly in Chattery Miss. I think the worst form of government is parliamentary, the British system. I don't think there is a worse form of government. I think you're better off with a king or dictator than you are with a parliamentary system. And that's because the parliamentary system is really based on a people's bribing others to form coalitions. Like in the case of Bibi Netanyahu, the only reason that he won any one of those parliamentary battles is because he bribed the religious parties into supporting him. The reason he didn't get reelected as prime minister is that the secularist party said, you know, so long as you're going to give all of these undeserved benefits to the religious party, they don't have to serve in the military, they don't have to pay tax, and they give a stipend to be religious, then we're not going to side with you anymore. And that's what Netanyahu's done. It's the only way that he can form a government is to bribe the religious party with such that, unlike everybody else, they don't have to serve in the military. Unlike everybody else, they don't have to pay taxes. And they can go around all day being religious. And at this point, the Blue and White Party, which is a kind of a liberal, centrist liberal party, and Likud, which is kind of a right-leaning centrist party, that neither got even half of the seats in the Knesset that are necessary to form a government. So now they're trying to broker power, and you broker power by offering favors to the other political factions. That seems to me to be the single worst form of government. Why do so many countries use it? Now, I'm not telling you that
they keep them in power. It has nothing to do with what they're going to do. They just want to be.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably only one form of free government that makes any sense, which is it would have to be an enlightened oligarchy. And of course, we speak of oligarchs disfavorably. The problem is that if you have a government where people who have no stake in the government can vote for politicians who are committed to doing what, like, on the Democratic side are, we'll forgive your student loans, we'll give you free health care, we'll tax the productive ever more. It's if you can vote to steal money from those who are productive and give money to the majority who are less productive, then you're going to end up with a unproductive, dysfunctional country. And that, unfortunately, is what happens. So the only country that has, the only kind of democratic, if you will, experience that has any chance of prevailing is those people who have a vested interest, who are net contributors. They own a business. They manage a business. They own property.
Under the Constitution, that was a requirement. You had to own property to vote.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That's true.
Yeah, you have a vested interest. You are you're part of the protective network of the country. And at that point, you ought to be able to vote. But a democracy requires an extremely enlightened group of people. Because in a democracy, you're actually voting for whether or not you're going to go to war, how much you're going to tax people, how much you're going to spend, what you're going to spend it on. Now, we have our representative government. I don't think there's a single democracy in the world today.
Our education system does is teach people that America is a democracy and that democracy is good.
Yeah, and if you go back just 50 or 60 years, the educational system would have said America is not a democracy, and they would have actually taught what the Founding Fathers wrote, which is democracy, you know, is two wolves and a lamb deciding what's for dinner. Our Founding Fathers of America hated democracy.
Hated.
They knew the democracy would absolutely, unequivocally fail. So, again, political correctness. It's a lie that 99% of people believe. And the world's full of them. And the world's full of this sense of entitlement. You're entitled to free health care. The system that was imposed means that those who pay for their health care are penalized. The ones who are responsible are penalized. They can't get the plan they want anymore. And that's also that those who don't pay for it get the most premium plan you could ever imagine. A plan way beyond what the people who are paying for it would even buy for themselves. And then if you have somebody who's parents or brothers or sisters or friends are unproductive, and they say, well, you know, I'm going to favor Obama because look at the wonderful thing he did for my family. Bull, he didn't do crap. He's never made an honest dime in his life. He didn't fund it. He just made sure that those who are responsible were punished, such that those who were not responsible could be rewarded.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of Abraham Lincoln, probably my least favorite president in history, but he did have one good line. He said, you can't make a weak man strong by making the strong man weak.
Correct.
And it's very true.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's true. Iowa's view of the covenant is the antithesis of the Christian view of salvation. The Christian view of salvation, you do nothing. It's a gift of God. You do nothing. Just believe. God knows the rest. My precious Jesus. What would God get out of a relationship where all the other people in the relationship don't do squat? They're nothing but parasites. What good would that be? But that is the Christian concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh's view is the antithesis of what we've been talking about from the beginning, which is why I wanted to begin talking about these things. Yahweh's view is you need to have the proper perspective. You need to see things in context. You need to invest the time such that you know and make the connections so that you understand. And then once you know and you understand and you see things from the proper perspective and you view things in context, then make a rational decision. But even then, don't look at the relationship as parasitic. Contribute. Do something. Take responsibility. Make a difference. You know, when we were dealing with the toter and the neck, and we kind of began to say, you know, we can't be playing around anymore. This is real. We have a responsibility here. And then when we came upon the NACRI and we recognized how much Yahweh had to say about what we all are contributing to and doing and the role we're playing and drawing, calling out his people and pulling them out of Babylon. It's real. This is a responsibility. We're in a family. And in a family, everybody needs to contribute. It's only enjoyable if everybody is contributing. You know, what fun would a family be? How dysfunctional would it be if everybody worked except one person, and that one person, maybe two or three people, they just sit on the couch all day long, they watch mind-numbing television, and expect to be fed and served, cleaned up after, and they contribute nothing, and everybody else does the work. Wouldn't you get resentful?
At some point.
And that's why the covenant is a participatory endeavor. Now, sure, all we need to do is understand, invest the time to answer the invitation, to walk through the door of Pesach. And yet when Yahweh threw it open in Yeshua's presence, there wasn't a single person outside wanting to come in. Sure. Yeah, Yahweh suffered the penalty of matzah, take the fungus of religion and politics out of our soul. But if we want to benefit, we need to understand what it is to answer the invitation and do our part. And
before you go to the temple,
we're only, you know, adopted into God's family, enriched and empowered, so that we can make a contribution today. I was was having a conversation, and we had a disagreement. It was over a small thing. It was this person was saying, you know, I only want to do it once, so I really want to do this project the right way and do it just once. And I said, that's not my preference. You have all the parts here to do it such that it's going to last a year. It's going to take 15 minutes to redo a year from now versus spending another 3 hours getting all the right parts to do it the right way. We have a lot of things to do. And that our most precious and most limited resource is time.
Mm-hmm.
So this old adage, let's do it once, not twice. It's a nice adage.
Put in work here.
Yeah, it's not always true. Sometimes it's better to do it twice. Yeah, and in this place, would I have been better off with yada yada if I only wrote it once as opposed to seven times? No. There probably isn't a single one of us, including me, that would have been here if we had known that way.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I shared with this individual is how important it is for us to recognize that by far and away our most limited resource is time. We only have so much time. So much time in a day. So much time before we are no longer able to share Yah's message in the way that we're doing it. Time is our most precious resource. And I think it's our responsibility to use it as productively as is possible. So that said, I'd like to return to where we were. We had just read Mizmor, Lyrics to be Sung, Psalm 23. And I'm here to share, and I think we did this after the program ended its broadcast, but was still in the archived version. There are some really interesting words, and in this, Kirk, you're prone to translate them. This is one of the places where you could disagree and go a very different direction and substantiate your disagreement in this particular passage. And it's one of those where I took a particular angle at it, particular perspective with it, and then said, here's my reasons for it, because, there are options. So we have, as terms that are interesting here, we have Mincha. Mincha is can be a gift. Mincha is a word that was introduced in Mizmor 6, which is how we began this whole series of books. And it is a contribution that is somebody is offering a gift which has been bestowed and appointed to assist. And then beyond Mincha, we have Ale or Ola, depending on how it's vocalized, which has a variety of potential meanings. It's based on the verb Allah, which is to rise, to ascend, a means of ascent. And the most interesting of all is Dashem, which I'm going to render in what follows as the one accepted and anointed. But there are lots of options with it as well. So this is Mizmor, Psalm 23. His desire is to remember. His will is to recollect, recall, and bring to mind all of your contributions, all of your sacrifices, all of your offerings, your gifts, and everything you have bestowed on behalf of others, along with those of your branch, your means of ascent and source of answers. Ele, Ola, or Ana, the acceptable means to respond and rise from Allah, to go up, to rise and ascend. The one accepted and anointed, Hashem, the one who has been prepared and prospered and then become overly satisfied. This is written in the Peel Imperfect, the Hoarded, first expression of malicious, which is best attested, attributed to the speaker and thus to Dode, where the object, which is the acceptable branch, is chosen to be put into action by the subject, who is God, with unfolding implications over time. Pause now and contemplate what this means. Selah. Now, if this is rendered correctly, and I'm here to tell you, I would encourage other people to do their own translation and come with a different rendering, by all means, you know, share that. But if I've got this correct, then what Yahweh is saying, and this is the reason we began as we did, that relationships are reciprocal. It's appropriate for Yahweh to contribute on behalf of those who have and will make a contribution. So, you know, you look at Moshe. Moshe was a runaway, a broken-down shepherd, an old man, tending sheep in Arabia, after having fled Egypt in chains. But he became one of the most important people in human history. And to a large degree, God credited him for what he would and eventually did do. And he did some extraordinary things. Dode was anointed and chosen, became Mashiach by Yahweh as a young boy before he had done anything on behalf of Yahweh. And yet, because Yahweh knew what he would contribute, Yahweh called him Sadak, his beloved son, the king of Israel. So, God does reach out to individuals whom he knows that, given the opportunity over time, have got the, I heard one of your favorite lines, they have the want to. Mm-hmm. And so he will reach out to those who have the want to and are willing to make a contribution. But beyond that, what this is saying is that not just our relationships reciprocal, and we both parties, Yahweh and ourselves, need to contribute for it to be meaningful. It's saying that God actually remembers and values our contributions. Now, I can tell you, and I've got a lot of flaws, but one of the things I would say that has been genuine is I have never sought anything, not recognition, not monetary gain, not even a praise from Yah for doing this. I do it strictly because I want to. Mm-hmm. I have the want to. I enjoy it. I think that, and have always felt, that to be credited, to be acknowledged for any of this contribution would be, in a way, to demean it somewhat. It's like being paid for the books. I think they would discredit them, discredit the effort. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of God remembering the contribution that we have made to his family is something I've never sought and have sought to avoid. But it's on this. That said, and I think it's an okay perspective for us to have, it's not a proper perspective for Yahweh. There is no father, including Yahweh, who's not going to acknowledge the contribution of a son or daughter to something that is eminently important. If you have a son or daughter who has done something important, made a valuable contribution to something that is meaningful and important to you, you're going to acknowledge it. you're going to appreciate it. Every father will. Every mother will. And so we should expect Yahweh to respond this way. And it's right for him to respond this way. It's right for us not to seek it. And it's right for him to tell us that I'm going to remember what you did. I'm going to remember, because it's a sacrifice of time. I'm going to remember what you offered. I'm going to remember what you bestowed on behalf of others. It should be that way. So his desire is to remember all of our contributions with those of your branch, your means of ascent, and your source of answers. So he's not going to just remember what we have contributed to calling his people out of Babylon. He's also telling us that he's going to remember Dod and Yosha's contribution too, but to a large extent, really, Dod's not Yosha's. So, Yosha is really many. It's a diminutive manifestation of Yahweh. It's not Yahweh's nature to even pat himself on the back, much less a diminished manifestation of himself. So, what he's saying is that I'm going to remember all your contributions, but I want to put this in context. The contribution that's the most important to me is the branch. Your means of answers. Those are means of answers. He is the answer man. All of the Psalms, the Mizmor, all of the Proverbs, the Mishnah, all of the lessons and Shamuel, Chronicles, and Kings. And all the prophecies. Dod is our source of answers. Do you want to know what Yahweh values, what kind of relationship he is seeking, what he expects from us? Study Dod. He says he's not only going to remember our contributions, but also the contribution of the one who was anointed. Well, that would be Dod. Full stop. Dod. Masayah. In this case, he used Dishan. So, I think it's appropriate for Yahweh to contribute on behalf of those who have made a contribution or who will make a contribution. In this regard, there are three individuals who I think stand out, Moshe, Dod, and Yosha. One of whom is being designated here by the reference to branch, being used as a means to ascend and provide answers as well as being acceptable and anointed. Only Dod met each of these qualifications. In the beloved 23rd Psalm, the author of the 20th of this war used the Shem to say, "You prepared a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint the Shem, my head, with oil. My cup runneth over." The proximity of the 20th Psalm to the 23rd and the common lyricists strongly imply that anointed would therefore be the most appropriate rendering. There is no other possible rendering in the 23rd. You anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. So why wouldn't we translate that Shan as anoint here?
That's what I got.
I don't see any reason.
In the Torah, you know, especially by Moshe, Dishan speaks of prospering, the body in Deuteronomy 31:20. But it's also used in Shemot, Exodus 27:3, when describing the construction of a receptacle to collect the ash and fat of the sacrificial lamb once the inedible parts are burned outside of the tabernacle. But isn't that in the same vein? Now, that definition doesn't fit in this context because the remains are without value, leaving us with anointed, acceptable, prosperous. Although the recognition that the remains of the Pesach lamb are to be wholly consumed by fire suggests that the only person capable of fulfilling this prophecy would be Dod, as Yosha's body was divinely incinerated in concert with the Torah. So what do you think? I mean, his desire is to remember all of your contributions along with those of your branch, your means of ascent and your source of answers, the one accepted and anointed.
I found before I looked at what you came up with, I did the same verse and found everything. One of them had a very distinctive negative or positive thing, which in context would make no sense to use the latter, which is Salah, which was very interesting in that it said it was a lifting of a sound or a musical term, which speaks to Dode as the, because in the context of that, we were talking about Dode before that. He was the musician, you know. The other term it'd be rejected or make light of, or that's not what he's talking about here. He's not rejecting this person or these people that he's discussing, so I rejected that. And it was interesting, too, that you had written Paul's now in contemplate, and there's a Hebrew word with the same root, the shemek and the lamb, and if you add instead of a aleph, it would mean to compare, and the words in that are you have, of course, in the first two, the two-letter root, you have a shield created from the thorny bush. You have to be led by Yahweh. And so it's most of these I can scratch out and say, okay, well, when I finally come to yours, I go, wow, that's good, number one, that I'm figuring some of these things out pretty straightforwardly. But, I couldn't build a real argument against it because I'd have to really twist the words a lot to come up with a different approach on this.
Yeah.
And the letters won't be.
Yeah, that was my view that while you could translate it other ways, it's really a lot of work. And if you have the 23rd Psalm, defining it, same author, same context, same idea, how do you fight that?
Yeah. sometimes.
You know, and it's my head with oil. So, I mean, that clearly is anoint.
Mm-hmm.
So it has Dode as the anointing.
But it's in the definition as well. Yeah. And it starts out with saying,
and clearly Yahweh values what Dode did. Yahweh has no issue telling us how impressed and how proud and how pleased he is with Dode.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that,
what he's saying is, you know, you aren't the only one that I'm going to commend. But what he's saying here, too, is that our commendation is going to be in accompanied by, in concert with, the accommodation of Dode. That doesn't put us at Dode's level, but it puts us in the same paragraph.
Puts us on the same team.
Yeah.
I'm in the same
group. We're coming off a division at the end of the game, you know. That's fine.
Yeah. It says that we're going to be in the same conversation in terms of Yahweh's recognition is doubt.
Yeah.
It works for me.
Yeah.
In fact, it's too good.
Yeah, it's too good for us.
So as we move on to the next statement, we've long come to realize that the symbolism of Leb heart has evolved over the past 3,000 years since this was written. In Dode's mind, as he scribed these words, the heart was the seat of judgment, the place where observation and experience coalesced with character and intellect to produce the best possible plan of action, one in which the individual was motivated and confident that they could achieve. Today, we would call it exercising good judgment, such that our actions are reasoned and right.
Thinking rationally.
This is what he... Yeah, thinking rationally. Exactly. Having the proper reasoned motivations. He wants to give you Nathan La'ata. That which is in accord with Ka. Your best judgment. You exercising good judgment, such that your heartfelt desire is determined by your conscience and as a product of observation, experience, character, and intellect, and fulfill everything you've advised for others. Wow, that's interesting. Now, it would be appropriate to render love as heart's desire for the likes of Dode, for those whose will is in sync with Yah's. When we want what God wants to give and what he wants achieved, we will always get what we desire, even without asking. Works pretty well. There is only one way to benefit from this extraordinarily positive position, that is to be observant, closely examining, carefully considering everything Yahweh has revealed to us through Mizmor such as this one, and then exercise good judgment regarding what we have learned. Now, this leads us to contemplating exactly what Yahweh seeks to fulfill through us and for us as defined by Kol Isha. Everything we have advised on behalf of others, what we have thought about, what we have accepted, what we have acted upon, including that which we have proposed while counseling. Now, this one, I want to tell you, got my attention. Because what God is saying, in essence, is that we're going to get what we gave. If we were talking about fire and brimstone and repent or you're going to burn in hell, we're probably going to burn in hell. If we
this just makes me think way, way back when you first started all this, back when, you know, we all kind of viewed the New Testament as having some authority, we translated through the passage where, you know, the Catholic Church uses to, you know, gather their authority, where they say, you know, Jesus said to Peter, whatever you hold truth on earth, I'll hold true in heaven. And we, you know, looked at the Greek words, and it was, you know, whatever you bind on people on earth will be bound on you in heaven. Basically telling them, if you start making up all these rules on people, I'm going to hold you accountable to those same rules. I couldn't help but think of that when I just read that part.
Works for me.
Yeah, brilliant. Exactly. Yeah. You know, if you have said that there are five conditions to be part of God's covenant family, and there's five benefits, and those conditions are enabled and fulfilled through the Moed Mikre, and that the way that we walk to God and become perfect, which is the second of the conditions, is to answer God's invitation to attend and celebrate his annual feast. If you say those things, then you're going to be held accountable by God based upon that standard. And if you want a standard that you know is going to, because you want to be held by it to a standard that you know is going to deliver the most optimum result, correct?
Right.
So God is saying, I'm going to give you what you gave out. You know, if you preach the gospel of the cute little naked girls of grace, then I'm going to give you to the God spell of the naked little girls. And see how that works for you.
Disregard me and have nothing to do with me, I'll disregard you and have nothing to do with you. No hell, no punishment, just nothing.
Absolutely.
But if you tell people that if they come to know, accept, act upon, engage in the terms and conditions of the covenant, and then what God is saying, then I'm going to to apply those same terms to you. Now, that's especially good since the acknowledging the terms of that covenant according to Yahweh puts us into being adopted in his family, being enriched and empowered and living with him forever.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have a better situation. But you better be careful of what you tout, what you evangelize, what you promote. You know, if you promote submission to Allah, well, you're going to end up being
submissed.
Subjected, yeah, to Allah. That's not a good thing.
No.
You know, you're going to get what you dealt out. The ultimate in fair. But boy, it's sobering. You want to be really careful that what you're saying is right.
Isn't that the Moab right story? For Jerusalem?
That is the Moab story.
I mean, isn't that the same thing? He promised them that, and they took it away from him, and then he said, okay, I'm going to give you what you got, what you did.
Mm-hmm.
You're consistent everywhere
you go. When Yahweh Hoshea says, you have forgotten my Torah, so I'm going to forget your children.
Yeah, forget your children. Mm. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you go, it's the same story.
The same story. He wants to give you that which is in accord with your best judgment. And fulfill everything you've advised for others. Now, I can't tell you that my translation here is perfect. But I can tell you that if this is anywhere close, this is one of the most sobering statements we have read thus far. This is God saying, I am really fair. You're going to get exactly what you deserve. You know, if you've had people kiss your ring and bow down to you, well, then you better pucker up. If you lord it over others, then, well, be prepared to be lorded over.
I gave it to Pharaoh, didn't he? He said he killed all the children, all the boys.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It'd be appropriate, you know, all the way through to think, what does Kol Hashah mean? And everything we have advised on behalf of others, we have thought about, accepted, and acted upon, including that which we have proposed while counseling, is what it means. It suggests that God is going to give us what we have given to those who have listened to us. Boy, you know, that's one of the reasons why if somebody can point out that you made a mistake, wow. You better get it right.
I jumped at the chance to fix it.
Yes. If we have the chance to fix it, we need to do it. If our advice was religious, we'll be discarded or incarcerated along with the religious. If political, then we will be disappointed by man and rejected by God. If consistent with the Torah, then with the methods and benefits of the Torah. And while it's fair, it should cause all of us to pause and read before we form opinions, and it should encourage all of us to think before we speak. Our best possible choice is to have our advice coalesce with Yah. It is the thing that if I were to be asked for advice, and I received a number of emails this week. I shared a number of them with some of you, that people who listened to a series of shows I did on Jeff Rentz radio. And they, you know, tried to sell me on their particular interpretation of things. And I was kind of harsh on both of them. So, you know, why is it you write these things without first reading? And that's really it all comes down to, is are we going to invest the time to learn? I'm going to take the time to know the truth so that we can respond appropriately. And so my advice to someone is don't pray. Listen. Don't yibber-yabber at God. Read what he had to say and contemplate what it means. Start
trust yourself to be smart enough to think your way through it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what drives me nuts is people who think, well, I'm not smart enough to do all this. I need to go to church and have someone to explain it all to me. No, you're plenty smart to do this. And if you're not...
When you say that God created a person who can't think, do you think that God is going to create a being who's not smart enough to understand what he had to say?
Exactly.
Huh. Yeah. What, are you going to insult God? That God is either too poor a communicator or too poor a designer to have his communication not mesh with his creation? Just think about how stupid that is. It's insulting. It's lazy.
You don't need someone else to think for you.
Right.
That's the society we have. It's created people that need people to think for them. They need to be told what to think.
They need to be told that man is responsible for global warming and we all need to do our part and make our sacrifice. Now, think it through. You know, the thing that has been, and I responded to an email from a covenant member earlier today, that with some of these letters that I had written, and they just said, you know, what is it they fought against reading? It's all there. Just read it. And that's the problem. They'd rather yibber yabber than they would read and listen. But I'm going to tell you, God's a lot smarter than any of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've invested 20 years doing this. I am so inferior to Dodd and his prophets, and infinitely inferior to Yahweh, that I've got to tell you that after doing it for 20 years, my response is even more extreme than it was at the beginning, which is, shut up and listen. Read. Thanks. Well, if you're going to say something to God, how about simply say, thank you. That was amazing. That was exciting. I enjoyed that. Thank you for sharing that with me. I appreciate that.
Can I suggest something or just add something along those lines?
Yes.
That one of the things that has been so helpful to most of us who've thought about this is your endeavor was, one of the endeavors was to separate us from preachers, let's say, and priests and rabbis and theologians. And you said, they are lying to you. And here's how I know. And you can read that and find out that you're on the same page when the bad example, perhaps, but the what I call the Nicodemus story, when Yahushua says to him, go to the Torah. You're supposed to know this. The answer is always in the Torah. This is my word. Go there.
Yes.
And until you learn or can translate some of this, or at least confidently translate enough words to realize that this is exactly what it means, not what the lexicons throw in to support their Bibles, then you'll build confidence in that, and then you'll be able to translate enough. I don't translate to write a better verse than you two guys, but I do translate to absolutely know or own that word. Okay, this is what it can be and what it can't be, and here's the context it can be in based on that, where I can say, okay, this is really what he's saying, and it's confirmed again and again and again and again in this verse or the next verse or some other chapter somewhere. And you will be able to do this yourself. I'm more excited that I can sit down and have a conversation with Yahweh, which I don't say a thing. I just read what he says and go, wow. And
really
I can do that. I can sit down and talk with God, the creator of the universe, Yahweh, any time of day. And that's an amazing thing. I never experienced that in my life before. I never had the courage to do this.
Listen to him, man. And our response is, wow.
Yeah.
Spectacular.
Good response. Yeah. It's the hey, behold,
I love
wow.
It.
Yeah. So,
give me a hand here. I'm really struggling. I'm not getting this one. Help me out.
That's fair. That's
yes.
A good question.
Well,
I've had those moments.
Yeah.
You're sitting there going through it, and you're like, "What? I know I'm missing something. Come on, yeah. Now, help me out here. What is it?"
The stars of Yada Yah or Intro to God or Question in Paul. Most of these people go there first and then go. Then start to read it for
us. I would definitely say intro to God. I think an introduction to God gives you the, Craig put it best, the toolkit. It breaks it down. It takes you through the process better than any of the others. If you want to get started, that's where I would start.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
That
yeah.
gives you that ground zero basis for translating. I wish I'd had it when I started translating.
You know, Dr. Jeff came down for dinner a couple nights ago, and we collectively pulled out that new short book, which is called Written in Stone, which I wrote about a month ago, and I don't know, it's about 100 pages or so, but it's simply a translation of the 10 statements. But it has a really interesting introduction, a very philosophical introduction on the difference between morality and legality and how that relates to free will. And then it goes through the 10 statements and does something that I didn't anticipate doing. It translates the 10 statements twice, once in Shemot, the standard place, Shemot 20, and then the body in 5. And that is actually a pretty good place to start, particularly if you are a secular Jew, which is the intended audience for all of us. If you are a rational, thoughtful, secular Jew that wants to know if there is a God, and if there is a God, did he communicate with us? And if he communicated with us, what did he say? That's also a pretty good place to start. It's very philosophical. And it's the only time that God actually provided a summary of his testimony. So it's a short read. It invites people. This is not too much for you to swallow. It's 100 pages. You can read 100 pages in a sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're intrigued by it, then whether you go to Yada Yah, or you go to an introduction to God, or you go to Questioning Paul, or you go to Observations for Our Time, it doesn't really matter which direction you go. But at that point, you've been introduced to the material. And, you know, the thing I was thinking about, Kirk particularly, and then JB, as you guys were talking, is the reason that I translate is to learn. Yahweh is the world's most extraordinary teacher. So I translate to learn. I write to share. So the translations are strictly because I want to learn. And the writing, all of the insights and all of that is to share. And it's this idea of sharing is what magnifies the positive aspects of an experience. If I were to see a spectacular waterfall, for example, like Victoria Falls in a full moon, with the mist of the falls creating these swirling rainbows. Now, it's an extraordinary sight. Now, if you're there with someone you care about, that you love, that you have a relationship with, and the two of you can share the experience, it's 100-fold more enjoyable and rewarding. And I think that's kind of Yahweh's response when we do what we do. when we translate his word to learn, and even if our response is nothing more than an appreciation of what he had to say, it makes the joy that Yao experiences in having created this charismatic light of the rainbow and waters in this universe so much richer.
Yeah, the other side of the sharing part is it does help with the learning. You know, every study has shown you when you try and teach something that you've learned, you learn it better. Yeah, it solidifies it in
correct.
Your mind when you try teaching it. So
you have to articulate
that's
it,
part of the reason I started doing more commentary on my translations. Is it helped me understand it better when I started trying to explain it as I was going.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You have one great line before we leave this. You have one great line in there that I just loved. You said, and I'll have to paraphrase it because I can't quote it, but you said that Yahweh can't command a human being because once you've given them free will, you can't command them. That's absurd to call it the Ten Commandments. And all of a sudden it struck me, well, it was just articulated so well, I'm going, duh.
You know, when I read this a couple of nights ago, I want to tell you that, and I've now read the opening three or four pages, five, six pages of Written in Stone, which you can buy if you want the hardback, if you want to give it to friends. I've probably bought 15 or 20 of them, and I give them out all the time because I think it's like $3.75 or $4 delivered.
$3.58. I'm looking at it right now because I've been meaning to order me a copy.
Oh, it's just amazing. I buy them, you know, by the dozen each time because it's the book I give out now. And I've read those opening four or five pages that explain the difference between morality and legality and why the Ten Statements are based upon a moral compass and why Yahweh cannot legislate, cannot command because of free will. And you read that, and it's almost like an out-of-body experience. It's like, wow. It just really resonates within. And I'd strongly encourage everyone to buy it, read it, buy some more, share it. My hope is that Yehudim, Jews, are, as we expect, right, rational, and that reading this will help point them in the direction of home.
I'd point out that nobody's making money off this. You're not selling these, and the person who put it up is putting it up at the absolute minimum that Amazon will let them put it up at. So nobody's trying to make a profit selling this book.
A book can be sold on Amazon.
Yeah, basically Amazon publishes the book on an as-bought basis, and you're required to put in a certain amount of quote-unquote profit. I think it's something in the range of like 5 cents a book. So nobody's trying
whatever
to get rid of you this book.
I don't even know where it goes if there is a profit of 5 cents a book because I've never received anything.
Yeah, no, that's the all. I forget. I don't know the name of the person off the top of my head, but the person who does all the books on Amazon is doing them all at the absolute minimum that Amazon will let him do.
That's correct. That is correct. That is correct. I was led to present Mizmor 20 before commencing with our review of Mizmor 6 and 7, which I've now translated. That's in chapter 3 of volume 3. The first is that it was written to enlighten us about what to expect from Yahweh during the time of Jacob's troubles, which is extremely pertinent for our target audience and Yah calling them out of Babylon at this time. The second was the use of Yeshua, salvation, in context with its root, Yasha, to save and deliver. The third was the Gaul, to look at and celebrate something in a conspicuous manner. And the fourth is its inclusion of Messiah, anointed Messiah. And the next two statements, we find all four of these words. And that's what I do. I follow words. And I follow words to their natural conclusion because, manifests himself to us through words. He is known to us through words, and so I follow where the words lead. Dod is encouraging everyone to listen to Ranan, and listen to him, to Ranan, to shout for joy. Ba Yeshua Atta, in your salvation. It is an expression of the benevolent idea that Dod, like every covenant member, celebrates the addition of each soul to the family. Dod is not celebrating his own salvation, but the salvation of those who have been adopted into Yahweh's family because of what he chose to write. This expression of joy is not based upon a nebulous religious notion or even popular belief, but instead in the name of our God, Yahweh. And on behalf of those who Dagal choose of our own accord to actually observe, closely examining, carefully considering the conspicuous banner which will be raised in recognition of its unfolding consequences. So here it is, the first of these two statements. May all of us shout for joy over your salvation. Isn't that amazing? Everybody in a Christian, they want to celebrate their salvation. That's not what Dod's doing here. We've said this so many times. Salvation is so small by comparison to eternal life, by comparison to being perfected by God, in comparison to being enriched, to being empowered, to being enlightened, and especially small in comparison to being adopted into God's family. It's just an afterthought. Okay, we've been saved. Great. It's all the rest of it. Now, while that's true up front, and it should be true, and it was true for Dod, and it's true for everyone I've ever spoken to in the covenant family, that even though that's true, we still celebrate the salvation of others. For us, it's all about the relationship and being empowered and enriched and enlightened and adopted. And yet we still celebrate the salvation of others. That's what Dod is saying. May all of us shout for joy over your salvation in the name of our God. Dod recognizes that while he made a tremendous contribution to helping us understand the means to being adopted into God's family and who Yahweh is and what he is looking for and expects in return, it's still Yahweh that's doing the saving. And upon our own initiative, by closely examining the conspicuous banner, the Dagal, by choosing to look at the beautiful celebratory signal, beholding the awesome sight of the sign, electing to actually observe the raised ensign, recognizing the unfolding implications over time. It is Yahweh's desire and will to satisfy and fulfill all of your requests and expectations. Now, our requests and expectations aren't to win the lottery. It's not to date the prettiest girl on the block. It's not to have a big house or a fancy car. Our requests are for understanding. Our requests are to be useful. Our requests are to be properly guided and to be accurate in our assessment, and then to have the opportunity to share in a meaningful way. God's desire to make all that happen. know, it's, you're in great shape when you're like Dode. If you want what God wants, you're going to get what you want. That's what this says. And it's Yahweh's desire and will to satisfy and fulfill all of our requests and expectations was set into the context of, may all of us shout for joy over your salvation in the name of our God and upon our initiative by closely examining the conspicuous banner. If we're aware of what God said and we're celebrating what's important in terms of the redemption of his people, then indeed, we're going to get our heart's desire. Context is king. And it's a shame that so few people contemplate what God says in the context in which he said it. Speaking of those who are observant, closely examining and carefully considering what he has revealed for our edification, Yahweh is committed to satisfying our requests by fulfilling our expectations. But here, they say context is important because this was written to those who were saved in the name of Yahweh, who are playing a role in the salvation of others in the name of Yahweh, who choose to look at the conspicuous and celebratory banner which has been raised. Now, there is every likelihood that we are collectively contributing to that banner. Not with our words, but with our desire to correctly convey his and encourage people to think about his. Many of the words written on that sign will have come from Dode. All will be inspired by Yahweh, either directly through his prophets or born out of thoughtfully considering what they have written. And that's JB and Kirk, that's really the joy of what we do.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
By taking the time to study the words and the letters that comprise the words, thoughtfully considering what Yahweh has revealed through his prophets, is how we are inspired. I don't think we have inspiration any other way.
No.
I think because we are doing that, because we are collectively devoted to appreciating and sharing and understanding the full extent of what Yahweh shared with us through his prophets, that it's very possible, likely, that what you're listening to now and what you read in these books plays a significant role in the sign that Yahweh is lifting up. This could well be the sign. That doesn't make us special, only in the sense that we're conveying something that is the most important thing to be known in the universe. I did an interview last night with Barry Farber. Barry Farber was the first ever talk radio show host. Invented the whole genre. And he kept on introducing each segment by saying that we are now listening to the most interesting man in the world. Now, this is a man that has interviewed tens of thousands of guests. And he kept on saying, based upon what you are sharing with us, you are easily the most interesting, most important man in the world. And my answer was that, in actuality,
what I'm sharing is the most interesting
of the sort. But based upon what we have learned, based upon what we have translated, based upon the merit of what we are sharing, it is true. What do you guys think about that?
Well, it's talk about Yahweh. I'm quoting Yahweh is the most interesting thing in the world. So, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd read
if you're one of the few people.
Yeah. I've read your, you know, in the company of good and evil, I've learned a little bit about your life. You had an interesting life. You're not the most interesting man in the world. You are discussing the most interesting message in the world.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's true.
Makes your message the most interesting that you're delivering.
That was my point. The message is the most important and the most interesting in the world. And if you're one of the few people that is credibly sharing that message, then as a message,
it makes you interesting.
Yes.
Right. We become most interesting messengers in the world. Not because of our own credibility, because of the credibility of the message we're sharing.
Yes.
What message could be more important than that of the creator of the universe?
None.
Yeah, there's just none. So, you know, we ought to keep that in mind. It was when we stumbled upon the NACRA, which wasn't by design. And when we stumbled upon Choder, which again was not by design, the first response was, oh, no, 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 no. Where we're just having a grand old time being anonymous, making our contribution, having all of the opportunity in the world and no responsibility. This is the world's best job. And then we read that Yahweh predicted what we would be doing and acknowledged the importance of what we were being doing. And all of a sudden, there was responsibility. And that's how I looked at it. Now, that's responsibility. Yahweh is counting on us to do the right thing. And you'd say, well, that's arrogant. No, it isn't. God likes to work through people.
Yeah.
And all the people he ever worked through were flawed. And if the job that we have is being one of the few people calling out in the wilderness to say, prepare yourselves for the arrival of Yahweh. Well, the last guy that did that got his head handed to him. You know? But what did Yosha say about it? This guy's important. What we're doing is extraordinarily important. So important, God himself acknowledged us. And with that comes responsibility. I don't want to let him down. And more important than not wanting to let him down, I want to do everything I can to achieve the result that he is desirous of achieving. And don't want it ever to be said that we sloughed off. We didn't give it our all. And therefore, there are scores or hundreds or thousands, millions of Yehudim that never answered the call because we failed to do the job as well as we could have or should have. So that's where we are. This Yahweh is again talking about the sign that he's lifting up. The sign is comprised of his message, but there is more to it than just translating what Yahweh had to say in the lingua franca of our time. Because we live in a world that is so corrupted by political correctness, so corrupted by religion and politics, that for Yah's message to be received, for it to be processed, for it to be understood, we actually have to put it in perspective, help people understand it, hold their hand through the process, explain what it means. Guys, you read some of my insights and ideas and suggestions. And my guess is now all they do is it helps reinforce what you already know. But if if you're turning to this for the first time,
big deal.
It's those insights and the conclusions that can be drawn that are really the credibility that that draws you in, that helps you gain the proper perspective. And so I think you have to have both, and I think Yahweh is doing with us a it's a different role, of course, than the role of Dod and Moshe, because they were inspired prophets, and we're not. We're inspired by the prophets.
I didn't need to know the prophet. He had 40. He said, now go out and tell them what they said. I mean,
today's world right now. The job is so different. The world would not benefit from having another prophet. The world benefits from somebody focusing on what the prophets had to say, explaining what it means, how it applies to our time, to our lives, what God is asking of us. That's what is needed today. We don't need another inspired prophet. God doesn't need to tell us anything more about our future. The task is understanding what's already been said. That's the wonderful job we've been given. And we're not given it uniquely. Everybody is welcome. You know, I think we'd all be delighted if there were a million candidates for Necri, observant foreigner, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
And not quite as excited if there were 1,000, and not nearly as excited if there was 100. But yet, we'd still be pleased if there were 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's time is short and the job is massive. We're not going to be shortchanged at all if you all want to join us. But if you want your requests answered, if you want your heart's desire fulfilled, the single best recommendation is to listen to what God has to say, to observe what He revealed, and have your priorities be in line with His. It all works out beautifully when that happens. I'd say that as we consider this, that the flow really of the sentence itself that we've just examined is interesting. And that the fulfillment of our requests and expectations follows the celebration of not just our salvation, but of the salvation of others. This isn't God granting temporal and mundane prayer requests and the here and now, but instead promising that life with Him and the hereafter will be extraordinarily fulfilling. This serves as an affirmation that we've been right all along. Our salvation is far less appealing than the prospect of exploring the universe with our Creator and with our Heavenly Father, enriching, empowering, enlightening us every step of the way. And it gets us right back to the nature of relationship. God wants to spend eternity with those who are inquisitive, those who will translate, those who will think, those who will share. What good would eternity be for God if those he empowered to live with Him weren't also inquisitive and desirous of sharing? Even if they were inquisitive but didn't want to share, what good would that be? And just because you're studious and thoughtful and understand, but you don't share it with anybody, what kind of fun would that individual be in eternity? Oh, yeah, there's old Einstein over there. But Einstein, he's not going to share, this Einstein, not going to share any of his realizations. He's just going to keep them all to himself. Well, I guess that's better than spending time with the dunderhead, but not by much.
that much of a conversation.
Yeah.
One person don't talk.
So this perhaps is the whole idea is, individually we ought to listen to God. And if we're going to yibber-yabber, it ought to be us sharing what we've heard. How about that?
That's it.
Listen to what God has to say, and then share what you've
heard.
Said. And when you do that, God's going to treat you in a manner that's consistent with what you've heard and said. And that ought to work because what he said is magnificent. Well, I'm going to go off and check my lines to make sure I'm not blown out to sea. It's blowing over 30. There's a couple of times during this broadcast that I thought we were rocked so hard that I was going to be catapulted off into the sea. But nonetheless, here we are. And I'm grateful to be tied up to this dock. I'm in the city dock now, no longer behind a house. And not only delighted to be here, but, I was late, but the whole experience of helping these tattered sailors, 65-foot sailboat, that...
sailboat? Wow.
Yeah, coming down from Jacksonville, that were in 20-foot seas.
I didn't realize there was that small a boat.
You know, seas that were breaking halfway up the mast of their sailboat. Ripping, it's almost every part of the sailboat is broken. And they yelled to me as they were coming in, and they wanted to know what dock I was on. And they were supposed to be in B dock, and I said, no, I'm on A dock. And yet they just brought the boat right here, because I was the one person on the dock, and it looked like I was willing to help. And it was the easiest place for them to slide in. And I said, this is B dock, your reservations for B dock, and you're sitting out right behind me on A dock. But hey guys, it's a pleasure to have you here, and enjoy. And they explain why they didn't go to the other dock with the current and the wind. I say, I'd have made the same calls. You made the right decision, and just the humanity of the whole thing and surviving that kind of a challenge. And then helping a neighbor out. And we're going to endure some major, major winds tomorrow. It makes you feel alive. It's an adventure. And there's you can see why likes people who are like-minded. When I got into the boating life, and I had this experience once when I was very young, It's just a camaraderie of people that share a passion and common interests. Nobody's uppity. Nobody's lording over anybody else. Everybody's at the same level, and we're all just sharing our passion for something that we enjoy. It's a voyage of discovery, if you will. Seamanship and going off and exploring islands and coastlines. Isn't really a lot different than exploring God's Word, going on a voyage of discovery through the words. I think everybody knows that I named my boat Kara, a welcoming invitation, and my dog Asher, benevolent and beneficial relationship. My tender, which I use for diving and exploring, is named Shamar, to observe, to closely examine, carefully consider. Every part of life is a learning experience. I had lunch with a fellow today that is part-time as a theoretical in theoretical physics, and we talked about Tesla and Einstein and time and energy and matter and creation it was a voyage of discovery through dimensions. and the inventiveness of men and women throughout time. So, all of life should be that way. The more we know, the more we learn, the more connections we make, the better we understand Yahweh, what he's offering, what he expects in return. It is a voyage of discovery. And in Yahweh's case, the discovery is not just through his words, but is also evident in the universe that he created. Every aspect of it, the number of dimensions, the nature of the elements that comprise it, carbon with molecular weight of 6, representing the carbon life form known as man. Water being such a unique part of it, with the unique property that water is the only compound that when it's cool, it actually expands, and how important that is for life. There's just, you know, so much to appreciate how old the universe is, how it's consistent with the Yahweh's 6 days of creation, and yet also consistent with 15 billion years, and how Yahweh is a being of light, and light energy is the substance of matter, and that matter is simply a diminished form of light, of energy, and how time represents the means to prophecy both past and future, and how time is consistent and light is consistent with the Hebrew language itself. It's just all of it. It is an opportunity to learn, to know, to understand, and then ultimately respond in a proper and positive way to what Yahweh is offering us.
Well,
so I wish you all a good night. Let's hope the winds die down and don't blow us away. And may Yah bless those of us who are celebrating an early Sukkah. We'll finish our celebration as the week transpires. May Yah bless you all. Good night.
Yah bless you too.
Good evening.
Hi, Jane.
Shalom.